On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The loose nuclear material story that emerged last month was a chiller. 50-year-old Russian smuggler Oleg Kintsugov was supposedly a trader in fish and sausages. But when the Georgian Secret Service arrested him, they found in his jacket pocket, casually wrapped in plastic, 100 grams of enriched uranium, weapons grade. Back in his apartment, he boasted, he had kilos more, enough for a suitcase bomb, enough for a terrorist to take out a city. All he wanted was $1 million. Instead, he's in jail, but others aren't. Nuclear programs in Iran and North Korea may be dangerous, but security pros say the rogue trade in nuclear materials is more dangerous and being addressed far too slowly. Up next on Point, stopping the suitcase bomb. With me today from Washington is Joseph Cirincione. He's Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. He was Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and for 9 years on the staff of the House Armed Services Committee and the Committee on Government Operations. He's out with a new book titled Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. Joseph Cirincione, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your book covers a lot of terrain, and it does not ignore sort of traditional proliferation, the kind that people are very worried about right now with Iran and North Korea, talks going on in Beijing. But you say, with all that threat, the threat of nuclear terrorism is greater and more serious. Why?
Well, Iran and North Korea get a lot of the media coverage, and these are serious problems. But even if Iran and North Korea were to get a weapon, it's highly unlikely that they would actually use it. They would be deterred by the same forces that deter other states and have for the last 60 years, the certain knowledge that if they should use a nuclear weapon against us or our allies, there would be a devastating and immediate response that would end their regime and their lives. Terrorists, on the other hand, if they could acquire a nuclear weapon, are much more likely to use it. Unlike states, they don't have a national territory or a national future to defend. And many of them are this new messianic or apocalyptic brand of terrorists, people who are seeking to bring on a final great conflict, even a religious conflict that they believe will lead to a better world. So they are much more likely to actually use the weapon. The good news is that terrorists cannot build a nuclear bomb from scratch. They can't make the material, the highly enriched uranium or plutonium. That requires a huge factory, an industrial complex, tremendous capital and energy and technical know-how. But if they could get that material, they could almost certainly fashion a crude device and then easily deliver it and detonate it on an American city.
And the weight of your book points out that they don't have to build the factory to refine weapons-grade material. An awful lot of it has been refined and is lying around, not adequately secured. You have said that when it comes to policy and priorities here, the TV show 24, which opened its season depicting a mushroom cloud over Los Angeles, is more on target than the U.S. government. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm a fan of 24, and I watched that episode where they actually did it and detonated a nuclear device in L.A., a small suitcase nuke.
Right.
And number one, this is quite credible. We do not know how many small man-portable nuclear devices are still in the arsenal of Russia. And one of these could be secreted into the United States. This is a realistic possibility. Number two, the terrorists might not actually have to steal an entire nuclear weapon. If they could get their material, they could almost certainly fashion together a nuclear device and set one off. We've done studies on this. The government has studied, could an advanced terrorist group actually do this? And the answer is yes. 2 to 3 technical experts, a couple of years tops, and once they got the material, they could make a device. And the LAPD in 24, the CTU, the counterterrorism unit, by the way, there really is a CTU. I'm actually going to go out to speak to it next month. they were much more concerned about stopping this terrorist threat than our actual government is right now. We spend about $1 billion a year on a number of very effective programs to try to round up that loose nuclear material to secure those nuclear weapons before terrorists can get to them. But this is a pittance. We're just creeping along at a petty pace here. We spend $1 billion a year. That's about what we spend every 3.5 days in Iraq. We're just not making the top national security threat our top national security priority.
Now, why do you think that is? And I ask because we've heard, and on this show for years now, here's the threat. If it's going to happen within a decade, we heard former Senator Sam Nunn on Morning Edition just last week saying it's coming at us. Hundreds of billions spent on Iraq, not nothing spent on this, but you and others say that if we just spent $3 or $4 billion, we could clean up all the loose nuclear material around the world, or nearly all. What's your explanation for why that has not become a top priority?
Well, I believe it doesn't fit in with other agendas. For example, when you look at why we invaded Iraq, the number one reason was allegedly to get rid of Saddam's threat to build or use nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, but it was also about beginning a process of regime change in the Middle East. It was also a revenge for Saddam's previous actions. It was also a desire by some to show that U.S. military force could be used effectively and we could use the military to transform the world. There was a variety of agendas, and there are others there, that all merged together. The problem with getting rid of nuclear terrorism is that it doesn't merge with an agenda for regime change or global transformation.
A big ideology.
Or a particular state or an ideology. The programs that could eliminate nuclear terrorism in 4 years, if we actually put our mind to it, tripled the funding, gave it top-level presidential attention, we could eliminate the threat of nuclear terrorism in the next term, first term of the next president. Those programs do only one thing. They get rid of nuclear terrorism. They don't solve these other agendas. And because of that, and by the way, they don't make a lot of money. There's not a lot of profit there. You're not building something. You're not churning out a new weapon system. Mm-hmm. You're getting rid of old weapon systems. So no lack of profit, lack of other strategic or geostrategic agendas, and a lack of, I think, political saliency. It hasn't been seen by politicians as sort of a winning issue for them. I think this is a mistake, but it's those three reasons, I think, that so far have kept nuclear terrorism sort of on the back burner.
Not enough profit, not enough ideology wrapped around it, but we're talking about lives. And if it happened, we shudder to think of the ideological consequences, the political consequences on the other side of a nuclear attack. Where is all this material that's laying around vulnerable to being bought, snatched up, smuggled by terrorists?
Well, most of it is in the states of the former Soviet Union, so Russia, but also Ukraine, Belarus, Turkmenistan, other states, even these small Uzbekistan states that are right near the conflict areas we're currently engaged in, have enough fissile material for dozens of bombs. Most of it is in Russia itself. We estimate there's, for example, about 1,000 tons of highly enriched uranium stored in Russia. Some of it in weapons, but much of it in raw form, easy to be stolen or procured through corrupt officials. And about half of it is in very poor security conditions, some of it guarded by little more than a chain link fence, a padlock, and a guard that works during the day. In 2001, 2002, the last year we have accurate statistics, the Russian authorities reported that they had 4 incidents of terrorists casing fissile material storage locations, places where we were storing this material. They detected the terrorist surveillance and disrupted it. Just last month, we had an incident reported where a former guard was selling highly enriched uranium to a group that he thought was a terrorist group.
It turned out to be a sting operation. We talked about it was the Georgian Secret Service who pulled him in, but he was ready and said he had kilos of it in his apartment.
Right, and this was the real stuff. This wasn't a scam. He said he had 2 to 3 kilos in his apartment building, not quite enough for a bomb. It takes about 25 kilograms. Some believe you can do it with half of that if you know what you're doing. But he had it, and he was ready to sell it for a pittance to these groups. We know Osama bin Laden, as reported by the 9/11 Commission, tried to buy highly enriched uranium. So this is not a fantasy. This is not something that this could happen. They've tried to buy it. Fortunately, in that particular case, it was a scam, and he bought for a couple of million dollars a load of radioactive junk. But they're trying to do this. The supply is out there. The number one threat is the state of the former Soviet Union. But there are also research reactors that we and the Russians helped sprinkle around the world during the heyday of nuclear energy in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that use this highly enriched uranium as a fuel. These are small reactors. They're often in universities. For example, current Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, when he was chairman of ATM University down in Texas, ATM has a small research reactor that uses highly enriched uranium. The problem is some of these reactors have enough material as fuel that could be used for a bomb, and the security is very low. They're guarded like they were library books, not like they were weapons. And finally, you have states such as Pakistan in particular, where they have enough material for between 50 and 100 bombs, have constructed a half a dozen or dozens of bombs themselves. But it's an unstable state. It's got strong Islamic fundamentalist influences in the military. It has armed Islamic fundamentalist groups operating on the territory of the state, including possibly Osama bin Laden himself. If something should happen to that government, if one of the assassination attempts should succeed, who gets the weapons?
Joseph Cirincione is with us. His new book is Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. In a few moments, we'll hear from one of those in the U.S. government who's tasked with going out and tracking this stuff down. But, Joe, I wish you'd give us a little technology lesson here just for a second. We're going to hear a lot about nukes in the next week. Iran preparing, we're told, to sort of open up these centrifuges that would be separating a lot of the weapons-grade uranium out from the mass of it. That task of refining this material, what is it? Why is it so labor-intensive, and why is it such a magnet for terrorists to look at the material that's already refined? Take us into the science side of this for a minute.
Thanks for asking. I spent a lot of time researching this for the book, Bomb Scare, and trying to find a way to talk about this so that the average citizen could understand the technology behind this. Just to give you one example, most of the money we spent in the Manhattan Project when we developed our nuclear bomb over 60 years ago was spent on this part of it, on making the material. It cost about the equivalent of $23 billion, and most of it went to creating a brand new industry. They built the equivalent of the U.S. automobile industry back then just to enrich uranium. And the issue is this. Natural uranium is mostly this isotope, U-238, perfectly fine isotope, but it doesn't undergo fission fast enough to sustain a chain reaction that you need for an explosion. But a very small part of it, less than 1%, is U-235. That isotope, that uranium atom, if hit by a neutron, splits in two, sends out a spray of other neutrons, and hits nearby uranium atoms, and they too start this reaction, and you get this chain reaction.
So that's embedded in your natural uranium. That's embedded in natural uranium, but you've got to split it out, and that's where the centrifuge comes in.
And so what you've got to do is turn that uranium ore into a gas. So Iran is doing this right now, for example, at this facility at Isfahan, which I visited a couple of years ago, turn it into a gas, and then put this gas into these centrifuges. These look like hot water heaters, but there's giant rotors inside that whip the gas around at supersonic speed. So the heavier element goes to the outside, and the lighter 235 stays in the center, and you can then siphon that off. And now you have a gas that's slightly enriched, that has slightly more U-235 atoms in it than you did before. But one whipping around isn't enough. You have to do it thousands of times. So if Iran was to able to, for example, assemble the 3,000 centrifuges they say they're trying to put in place this spring, it would take them a year of pumping gas into those centrifuges to enrich enough uranium for one bomb.
So there's a huge investment here. I mean, this is gigantic. Thousands of centrifuges going for at least a year to be prepared to get out that uranium-235, the enriched uranium.
At the end of the process, then, you have a gas that you then turn into a metal that's 90% U-235, and that's what you need for a bomb. But Iran is saying they're not doing this to make a bomb. They're just doing it to make fuel, which is plausible because the same process is used to make low-enriched uranium, that is 3%, 5% U-235 enriched uranium, and that's what you use for fuel rods. Mm-hmm. And that's the core problem. The very same facilities that can enrich uranium for fuel can enrich it for bombs. The same facilities that can separate out plutonium from this mixture for fuel can also separate out plutonium for bombs.
But the upside,
same facilities.
The upside in this labor-intense undertaking is, I mean, that if you can get the already enriched fuel off the market, get it secured, this is a huge barrier to terrorists. That it's very hard for anybody but a government to set up thousands of these very sophisticated centrifuges. But the idea that we're leaving potentially vulnerable the material that's already been enriched after all that effort has gone making it kind of incredible.
That's exactly right. That's why I think we have to treat the material as if it were a weapon itself and guard it at the highest possible level, because if we don't treat it like it's a weapon, it could become one. We have to start taking this stored material seriously and upgrade it, upgrade the security of all the facilities around the world. This is in our national security interest. This isn't a foreign aid program. This is for our protection that we should do this. And by the way, eliminate as much of it as possible. Here's the good news about enriched uranium. You can downblend it. You can take it from highly enriched uranium, mix it with natural uranium, downblend it to low enriched uranium, and fashion it into fuel rods. In fact, we have a program to do exactly that. We've bought 500 tons of highly enriched uranium that used to be in Russian warheads, have downblended it, and we are now burning it in U.S. nuclear reactors. One out of every 10 light bulbs in the United States is fueled by material that used to be in Russian warheads. Because half of all the nuclear energy, so about 20% of the electricity in the United States is produced from nuclear reactors. Half of that is coming from uranium that used to be in Soviet warheads. That's a real success story. We have to duplicate that, accelerate that program, get more of it, and burn it up as quickly as possible.
So just step on the accelerator, get this stuff corralled. It's not always easy, as you point out, but once it's done, you've built a real canyon to the possibility of terrorists getting their hands on it. I want to begin to turn to our callers, if I may. Joseph Cirincione is with us. His new book is Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and he's paying a lot of attention here to the suitcase bomb threat. Sean's calling from Walcott, Connecticut. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Sean?
Well, I'm a first responder. I work as a firefighter, a paramedic. I'm also a member of Massachusetts Task Force 1 FEMA Urban Search and Rescue.
Okay.
The general public is kind of clueless as to what's going on, and even some of the first responders are not prepared for this.
How do you respond to a suitcase nuclear bomb in an American city? I mean, what do you even do?
Well, the problem is that we got to get people to recognize what's going on. I know that in Britain they have signs in the subway saying, "Watch for is that your actual package or is that your actual suitcase?" The American public is believing that no. It's not going to happen here. However, we can also see that it's going on in the movies. We see the show Cell on Cinemax.
Mm-hmm.
We see 24, which just had a nuclear bomb set off in it. They're aware of it, but they're also believing that it's not going to go. It's not going to happen to them, which is obviously happened. You know, like in Katrina, it's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to be prepared for it, and I don't have to worry about it. I'm not going to spend the money to train my first responders and spend money to be prepared to live out a nuclear holocaust. Or
better still, spend the money to mop it up in advance, but you're a first responder and staring at it. Joseph Cirincione, what about this issue of denial? You talked about why the government may not be stepping up. What about public demand that the government step up? Do you see a country in denial, ignorant or in denial, or just not wanting to think about the horror potential here?
It's it's not quite denial because, you know, we do have these programs and they do work. It's just that at the highest level, at the political level, at the presidential level, it's not getting the attention. And for things like this, there are bureaucratic problems. There are difficulties that have to be overcome. The Russians are resistant to us going into some of their most secret facilities. You need a president who's engaged, who's saying, do it, solve the problem in order to push it all forward. Interestingly, at the local level, I've met a lot of, first responders, but local police forces that are very worried about this, that feel the same way Sean does, that they need to be ready for this, even if the federal government isn't, because they're the ones that are going to have to deal with it. So, for example, I talked last year to a member of the New York Police Department, intelligence unit, whose job it was to go out to all the facilities in New York State where they could be storing radioactive material for medical purposes, cancer treatment, for example, or dental x-rays, and make sure that all that material was secured and accounted for and there weren't any suspicious bulk purchases going on. They were taking that job on after 9/11 because there wasn't a federal program that required this kind of security.
But that's all about catching the pitch after it's been thrown, whether it's first responders or, you know, God forbid, trying to deal with the aftermath of a bomb, or even there's so much talk about port security, about stopping this stuff from coming into a container in an American port.
Yeah.
But all of that is trying to catch something once it's already loose rather than going after it when it's containable at the source.
I'm with you completely. I don't object to there being portal monitors that could detect nuclear material. There's several problems with it. It turns out it's very hard to detect actual bomb material. It doesn't have a strong radioactive signature. It's easy to smuggle it in with the minimum of shielding. But if that's your line of defense, it's too late. Like horseshoes, nuclear weapons have to get close. If they get into the port, that's where they can be detonated. They don't have to go through the portal monitoring. That's why Sam Nunn says that former Senator Sam Nunn, who's been waging a national campaign on this issue, that the first step for a terrorist getting the material is the hardest step is for them and the easiest one for us to stop. Every step after that becomes easier for the terrorists and harder for us. That's why our focus has got to be over there. We have to go to where the material is, eliminate as much as possible, and secure what we can't eliminate in order to prevent them from bringing it here.
Joseph Cirincione, stand by for a moment. I want to bring in one of those people who's working to do exactly that. Joining us from Washington, Andrew Bianowski is with us. He heads the Global Threat Reduction Initiative at the National Nuclear Security Administration, semi-autonomous agency within the U.S. government established by Congress in 2000. He's been working in nuclear nonproliferation for 17 years. Mr. Bianowski, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Joseph Cirincione is giving us a kind of sober assessment of where things stand. I'm looking back here at a record of interceptions of loose nuclear material in Podolsk and Vilnius and Munich and Prague and Paris and St. Petersburg. Is this the kind of work you do? Are you and your colleagues out on the highways and byways tracking this material down?
Yes, our team is going aggressively around the world. We are basically the first line of defense and are going to secure vulnerable nuclear and radiological materials at their source in civilian sites. One of the things that we have done since our program was created 2.5 years ago is that the Global Threat Reduction Initiative has significantly accelerated our efforts to address these materials at these civilian sites, which aren't very well protective and which need greater security. Over the past 2.5 years, we have doubled the number of shipments in terms of removing materials from vulnerable sites. We have also converted 6 research reactors that use highly enriched uranium, and they now operate on low enriched uranium, which cannot be used in a nuclear weapon. So we agree that the threat is real. Our team is taking this very seriously, but I do think it's important to highlight is that there are programs such as ours within Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Administration that are really on the ground every day making a difference trying to secure these vulnerable materials.
So you're out there and doing your best, and we'll look at what's entailed in that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Are you welcomed with open arms when you go out, or are you having to come in, you know, hard and fast by night to, I don't know, put the padlocks on or take them off and scoop this stuff out?
Well, our program is a cooperative program, so you raise a very good question. We are not coming in under the cover of darkness to remove this material involuntarily. We negotiate with these institutes, these universities, these research reactors, and we have a very good cooperative program to try and make these actually programs be implemented. One of the things that I think is helping us is that we are addressing the same threat also in the United States. It was mentioned earlier correctly that, for example, in the U.S., we are converting some of our own research reactors from the use of highly enriched uranium to low enriched uranium. We just had two recent conversions at Texas A&M University and University of Florida, and that is so important because those activities help us internationally when we go overseas and trying to work with our international partners.
We're cleaning up, so why don't you do the same?
Exactly. If we're doing the same thing here in the U.S., they are more willing to also try and address the threat. So I think that is a very important element that gets back to your question of being able to do this on a cooperative manner and try and do so very quickly.
Joe Cirincione, you point out a lot of it is straightforward cooperative, as Andrew Bianowski describes, but you also point to some kind of Mission Impossible projects here when it's not so simple.
Yeah, well, I think Andrew's a hero, and the people that are working with him are doing a terrific job. That program needs to be expanded and accelerated. But what they do sometimes is under the cover of darkness cooperatively. It's all a joint effort, usually involving two, three, maybe four governments. But, for example, one of the ones that Andrew just talked about, the September 2005 shipment from Prague, they went in and they actually made the operation. It was a lot like Mission Impossible. After midnight, a heavily armed special police force led a cargo truck carrying about 14 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, almost enough for a bomb. Or some of our bombs could be made
right
with that little. Rushed it from the Technical University in Prague to a Russian cargo plane at the airport and airlifted it, that material, back to Russia.
But that's just taking it out of a university. Are they afraid of being intercepted on the way from the campus
yes.
to the airport? Is it that keyed
yes.
up?
That's exactly wow. right. They did it the same thing in August 2002 at this facility at the Vinča Institute in Serbios, another secret nighttime operation that lifted enough material for several bombs out of there. And in that case, they needed the cooperation of a private U.S. organization, Sam Nunn's organization, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, that ponied up $5 million to Serbia to provide for cleanup after the operation. Without that money, Serbia didn't want to cooperate. So that's an interesting example of government and non-government cooperation here. All these take cooperation, coordination, but once the package is put together, you find that most governments are willing to do this because it's a no-cost operation for them. And for us, we're talking basically about a few million dollars per conversion. Taking a highly enriched uranium reactor, converting it to low enriched uranium, costs about $2 to $3 million a pop. It's cheap.
Andrew Bianowski, do you feel the clock ticking? Do you feel yourself in a race against time and terrorists?
Yes, we definitely feel that the clock is ticking, and that's why I think the sense of urgency is so important. One of the things that has really helped us is that these initiatives, my program, GTRI, is included in the Bratislava Joint Statement that was issued by Presidents Bush and Putin back in February of 2005. And when they issued this very bold joint statement, they laid out much more aggressive schedules for us to accelerate and complete our efforts. In our case, we had a completion date to send all the Russian origin spent fuel that's located in 17 countries around the world back to Russia. The original dates were 2013. Those were moved up by more than 3 years, and that completion date is now to be done by 2010.
Let me go to Savannah, Georgia, and Christopher. Hi, Christopher. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, you know, for a kid, I've always been, like, afraid of, like, say, a nuclear holocaust, and I'd like to ask...
You and me, too.
I'd like to ask both of your guests, if, like, a nuclear... We've been hearing, if you listen to the people like yourselves that know a little bit about it, and if a nuclear detonation is imminent in a U.S. city, let's just say... New York City, for example.
Well, let's be fair. But, possible, and some say inevitable in time. I don't know about imminent, but yes, your question, Christopher.
Okay, yes. My question is, what is the most likely scenario of how it plays out after that? I mean, and as far as, you know, like the same way after like 9/11 and the World Trade Center, you know, we ended up getting into Afghanistan and the Iraq War now. I was just wondering, could this escalate somehow, like, you know, politically, that we would have, you know, the United States would react to where, for some reason, we had a nuclear holocaust? I mean, a worldwide,
that's an important exercise to try and imagine, to try and foresee. Christopher, let us pick it up. Joseph Cirincione, if it happened, the ripples out. You hear what Christopher's asking. What do you say?
Yes. Well, first, there's the destruction itself. Let's say it was a small nuclear weapon, say the size of what we dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. That's about 15 to 20 kilotons. That would destroy all people and buildings in about a 10-square-mile area, with then radiation spreading out with the wind several hundred miles downwind from the explosion. If it was a modern nuclear device, say a 1-megaton hydrogen bomb, the kind we still have, then you're talking about destruction of 150 to 600 square miles. So all of New York would be gone from that.
But presumably that latter is would be state delivery, not terrorist delivery.
That's exactly right.
So that's too big. Let us stick with the suitcase bomb or the terrorist bomb.
Which I think is the more likely. And in the case of 24, they used a 1-kiloton device.
Okay.
So it basically, you know, blew up 1 or 2 square miles, but still, you know, tremendous destruction, unlike anything we have ever seen in the United States. And then what happens is the political fallout, and I think this is what your call is getting to. You know, you could basically take the Bill of Rights and put it up on the shelf, and you might not see it again. There would be a huge demand from a very frightened public for harsh measures to make sure that there wasn't another nuclear device. And you might very well, if this was a terrorist case, be faced with a terrorist demand who said, we did it once, and if you don't say, take your troops out of the Middle East, we'll do it again. You can imagine the kind of panic and fear there'd be in the United States, the kind of demands for strong central authority there would be, and that kind of collapse of public confidence perhaps in the government could undermine the political structures, the economic structures. It could unravel some of the economic basis of this country. And, of course, since our economy is tightly connected with other countries, you could see huge global economic repercussions.
But Christopher asked about escalation. He asked about escalation. Does the U.S. have a policy here? Have we already put out a stone-cold threat to Pyongyang or Tehran saying, we don't care if it's got your fingerprints on it or not. If it happens, you know, your capital will be taken out. Jacques Chirac in France said that about Tehran, if it came from Iran. But if it's a terrorist bomb, is there a known plan for the U.S. response? Does, you know, somebody paid after 9/11, right or wrong target? Does somebody pay at the end of a U.S. nuclear weapon after a terrorist nuclear attack, Joe?
The president recently made such a statement right after North Korea tested in October and made it clear that if any device known to have come from North Korea were used against an American city, North Korea would be held responsible. And you could expect that we would hold the state responsible for a terrorist use of a weapon obtained from that state, either willingly or unwillingly. The trouble is proving it. Now, we do have something that's called nuclear forensics, and Andrew might want to speak to this. Mm. We can sample the fallout and get a nuclear fingerprint that can tell us the isotopic ratios, that can tell us where that device was likely built, from what country's reactor that material came from, as long as we have a sample of that reactor. And we do have samples from many reactors around the world, but it's not as precise as it could be. There's actually sort of a race to improve these nuclear forensics so we can pinpoint the origin of the material.
Let me put that to Andrew, if I may. It may be above your pay grade, Andrew Bianowski, but what about the aftermath? If it happened, how do you see it playing out on the other side?
Well, I mean, again, I can only comment on my specific program, which is one of several elements working to take this threat very seriously. And again, if there were a detonation of a crude nuclear weapon, it would be devastating. It would absolutely change the world as we know it. And that is why we are going around the clock to all these civilian facilities. The real problem, as was highlighted earlier, is that there are these nuclear and radiological materials located at thousands of sites in over 95 countries, and a lot of these materials do have beneficial, legitimate uses. And so our challenge is to lock down the material, convert these research reactors, remove the material, and downblend it, and try and achieve permanent threat reduction as fast as possible so that we never have to deal with those potentially horrific consequences.
Let me ask you, the question or the charge put here by Joseph Cirincione is that it's not being done fast enough, not enough resources are being put against it. He says with $4 billion, we could mop it all or mostly up in 4 years. You look back to the Bush-Putin-Bratislava compact and say, we're going aggressively here. We're going to do it by 2010. Have I got you right on that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, for us, this Bratislava joint statement and the initiative by President Bush and President Putin to really focus on this issue has been a huge acceleration for our program. If I could just cite a few numbers, prior to the Bush-Putin joint statement in February of 2005, there was only around 105 kilograms that had been removed from these civilian sites and sent back to Russia. Since February of 2005, and with this major shipment we had from East Germany in December, we have now removed an additional 391 kilograms of HEU in 10 shipments. That's enough material, if terrorists were to acquire it, to make more than 10 improvised or crude nuclear weapons. So we have found the Bratislava framework to be very useful. In fact, every 6 months, we have to give an update and a report to the president on what we're doing, what the plans are, and the next steps. And therefore, we have a lot of pressure and expectations on our teams to actually deliver and meet those targets. On the budget side, our program has also doubled from when our program was first launched 2 years ago, and the whole National Nuclear Security Administration nonproliferation budget has doubled since September 11th as well. So the funding is going up, and those are exactly the kind of resources we need to accelerate these programs.
Joe, secured nuclear material going up, funding going up. Maybe this acceleration you're asking for is already happening. Are you behind the curve here?
There has been movement in this direction. That's a good thing, but nowhere near what we need. So we're still talking about total spent every year on these programs is about $1 billion, more or less what it was before 9/11. Total personnel involved hasn't really changed. We haven't secured the rate of securing the material has accelerated slightly, but again, nowhere near where it should be since the 9/11 attack. So, for example, Andrew mentions that he's talking about some 40 countries where there might be civilian nuclear reactors using highly enriched uranium. My count is that there's about 100 reactors of that kind. And Andrew, you correct me, but I think we're talking about several thousand pounds of this material that needs to be secured. And so far, we've secured several hundred pounds of it. It's that kind of scale that we're talking about. It's doable. We can do all this. And the question is, are we going to do it at the present pace, which means we would complete this mission sometime near the middle or end of next decade, or do we accelerate it and complete it in this decade? I'm actually convinced that the first presidential candidate who seizes on this issue and says, I promise as president in my first term, I will eliminate the threat of nuclear terrorism, is the president who's going to capture the public's attention, who's going to have a winning issue that they can carry through the elections.
Andrew Bienowski, in brief, could we stomp on the accelerator here and do this much more quickly? Is it open to that kind of further scaling up?
Yes, it is open to the scaling up. One of the things that we have done, as I mentioned, the acceleration, but we're not stopping with some of the work we've already done. For example, our targets each year, as Joe was citing, are going to get faster and faster. So I noted that we had converted, for example, 6 reactors in the past 12 months. Well, we're going to do 7 in the next fiscal year, 8 in the next fiscal year, 10 in the next fiscal year, and also accelerate the programs to remove this material and downblend it. So, yes, we have done a lot. We fully realize there's a lot more to do, and we have to continue to accelerate to really address this very real threat.
Andrew, what's the total number of reactors that you're worried about?
The total number of reactors we are focused on converting is 129 research reactors. We have converted 48 of those, so we are, you know, about half done and have still quite a lot more to convert.
Andrew Bienowski heads the Global Threat Reduction Initiative. Mr. Bienowski, thank you for your time. Go get them. We're counting on you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Robert's calling from New York City. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think, Robert?
Well, you know, I think that it's not as big a deal as some of you guys are making it out to be. Maybe I'm an ostrich with my head stuck in the sand. I want to give you guys to correct my thinking here. But my understanding is it's very, very difficult and expensive process to build a nuclear bomb. And, you know, as we can see, because we've known that the North Koreans and the Iranians have been doing it for some time before they were actually able to get something close to getting off the ground with it.
But they're looking to get the material from scratch, Robert. And as Joseph Cirincione and Andrew Bienowski say, if terrorists get their hands on already enriched uranium, they're you know, a pretty good chunk down toward the goal line.
Well, but the miniaturization of a thermological nuclear device is still very, very high-tech stuff that I don't think that the terrorists are going to really be able to accomplish. So they're still going to be stuck with carrying the big boy or little boy on their backpack, and I don't think that can fit in a backpack.
Let us pick that straight up. Joseph Cirincione, there's Robert in New York City. He's not so worried. The challenge is too big for the terrorists, he says.
You're absolutely right about the thermonuclear device. That is the hydrogen bomb. So most of our bombs, most of the Russian bombs, we still have thousands of these, are hydrogen bombs, thermonuclear, very complex devices. They use plutonium cores, an implosion device, tough to make. Terrorists never could make it. The problem is they don't have to. They could go with the Hiroshima design. This was a design that we were so confident of over 62 years ago that we didn't even test it. We knew it would work. This is what's called a gun assembly device. You basically take one subcritical chunk of highly enriched uranium, so about 10 kilograms, you put it at one end of a gun barrel, and then you fire into it another subcritical element, basically like a gun, a howitzer, and you slam it in. As long as that slug is going more than 1,000 feet a second, you get a critical mass that, when the two join, detonates your nuclear explosion, gives you 15 to 20 kilotons worth of explosive
yield. How small
can
it be, the whole mechanism?
Well, the bomb we dropped in Hiroshima was about 1,000 pounds and 6 feet long. So, and you can make it much smaller than that now. So we're not talking about a suitcase nuke, but we are talking about a footlocker nuke. You could bring this thing in on a dolly, wheel it in. It would be probably by ship, maybe be by plane. You could FedEx it.
How heavy? How long? How big?
We're talking about hundreds of pounds. It's substantial, but it's not something that two or three men couldn't do, or you're just using a dolly, one man could wheel it in.
Let's get one more call from Des Moines, Iowa. John's on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Bob. A long time ago, I was in an Army unit in the Mideast that guarded nuclear warheads. And we had ADMs, an Honest John, an 8-inch, and Thor thermonuclears. It's not that easy to get their hands on it. And our officers pointed out, everybody who gets a nuclear weapon figures out it's only of use if you don't use it. I mean, take a look at Katrina. It smashed most of seven states. 2 months later, you know, another hurricane followed it up, smashed nine states, and we just sort of ignore it. So I got a feeling if you exploded a nuke, everybody would say, well, that's too bad. We should do something. And then we just, you know, Americans are all Cleopatras. They're queens of denial.
You think the country would really be that cool about it? But what, Joe? He was guarding nukes in the Middle East. What did you catch that?
Well, we during the Cold War scattered nuclear weapons all around the globe. You know, at our peak, we had something like 35,000 nuclear weapons ourselves, and the Russians matched that. In the 1980s, there was a global total of 67,000 nuclear weapons. We've cut that in more than in half since then, and the number of nuclear weapons, thankfully, is coming down. That's the good news. The bad news is there's still 27,000 of these things, mostly in the stockpiles of the United States and Russia. That's going to continue to come down, but even the official U.S. plan right now is still to maintain a stockpile of some 8,000 to 10,000 nuclear weapons indefinitely. And some of them, as your caller said, are very small. Imagine that, 8 inches in diameter. That's a nuclear weapon. We would have artillery shells that were nuclear. We have very small nuclear devices. That's not what we're talking about with the terrorists. That's beyond their capability. We're talking about the simple fission device, a gun assembly device, almost certainly using highly enriched uranium. The gun assembly can't use plutonium. That's the good news. The plutonium requires an implosion device. That's the kind of device that North Korea is testing. Much more complicated, probably beyond the capability of a terrorist. So your problem is actually fairly narrow. If you can just secure the HEU, or at least put most of your efforts at that, as one of my colleagues says, put HEU at the head of the queue.
Highly
focus
enriched
on
uranium.
That.
Yeah.
Focus on that. That's a job you could get done in the next 4 years, as my colleagues up in your branch of the woods, up at Harvard, Graham Allison says, this is the ultimate preventable catastrophe. We can do this mission.
Well, there's the upside, the positive. After a lot to fret about, $4 billion in 4 years, pedal to the metal, and we could get it done. Let's hope we do. Joseph Cerincione's new book is Bomb Scare. Mr. Cerincione, wonderful speaking with you in a fashion. Thank you very much for opening our eyes here today.
Thanks, Tom,
for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.